This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik. A warm welcome to all our regular listeners and, of course, to everyone who is tuning in for the first time. We are coming to you from Gothenburg in Sweden, and you can follow us through our website, redicecreations.com. We do interviews with researchers, authors, filmmakers on many different subject matters, information that we consider to be important, interesting, and intriguing. And we're not afraid to go into unknown areas and go where the information takes us. As we search for answers, no topic is off limits. The conclusion about the information presented, as always, we leave up to you. We are going to continue with program 2 today with Andrew D. Bashago. I know a lot of people out there who are hungry for more information from Andrew about his experiences and research. On our website, redicecreations.com, you will find part 1 of our interview with Andrew, a 2-hour long interview that will give you the full background story. So it's recommended that you listen to that before this program if you haven't already. Exopolitics.com is Andrew's and Alfred Weber's website. Also search for The Discovery of Life on Mars on Facebook.com for the Facebook group. So with that, welcome to the program, Andrew, and thank you for joining us again.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Henrik, and I look forward to today's discussion as well.
Absolutely, and we have two different strands, basically, of information we want to discuss today. One is, of course, about your experiences on Mars, to keep it short, and the other one is about the research that you've done on some of the publicly available photos of Mars from NASA, ESA, and so forth. But we do have a few questions that obviously have been coming in between these programs that we've done here, and so what I can do is just fire away a few questions to you that have been coming in, and we'll see if you have any comments on that. What do you think about that, Andrew?
That's great. Just fire away. I'm looking forward to what has been asked regarding our last time together here in Red Ice.
Absolutely, and it's been kind of varied, so to speak. But a few things that has been coming in is a little bit about the JumpGate device. Obviously, one question, for instance, was about from a person who mentioned what good is the JumpGate device if you can't take something with you, like a cell phone or a camcorder or video, so that you can record your experiences or anything with metal when you travel. And this particular guy said, I haven't been able to remove my wedding band for 30 years. Would I show up on the other end with 9 fingers?
That's very funny. I don't remember any protocol involving metal when Courtney Hunt took me to that CIA facility in El Segundo, California in the summer of 1981. In fact, I was so little trained on that jump room that we entered the building in the center of the building, on the ground floor, and we went up an elevator. And I didn't realize at the time that the jump room was the elevator. We arrived at about the 5th floor, and there was a counter there, kind of like when you have a Fijian suite in a law firm in the United States. You have sort of a central console where a receptionist or a secretary, sometimes a guard, sort of sits at this big counter, and you have multiple offices around it, sort of in a semicircle. So we arrived on the 5th floor there, and there was only one man sitting there. And he clearly knew who Courtney M. Hunt of the CIA was, because they sort of laughed derisively at each other when he walked into the room. And then Hunt had given me minimal training at another location in the San Fernando Valley about what was going to happen when I went to Mars. But I didn't realize that literally the elevator that we used to reach the 5th floor was the jump room. And so I said, where's the teleport? Because as a child in Project Pegasus in the early 1970s, I had really jumped through two devices. One was this basic Tesla energetic array that was in Building 68 at the Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey. And it consisted basically of two parenthesis-shaped objects that were about 8 feet tall. They were battleship gray, and they were facing each other about 10 feet apart on the shop floor. And they would propagate this field of energy that sort of looked like water falling on a public water sculpture of some kind. But when you went up to about a foot, they looked like a raster on the energy field looked like a raster on a TV set. Now, when we were using that device, that Tesla energetic array, to reach Santa Fe, New Mexico from Woodridge, New Jersey, or when we were returning to Curtiss Wright from an identical lab with an identical device in it at the Sandia National Labs, in Sandia, New Mexico. We could not bring any metal along. I mentioned, I think, during the previous our previous conversation here in Red Ice that I had to put this sort of Boy Scout belt on with a plastic buckle.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole time that I was in the company of my father or project people in New Mexico, I always felt somewhat embarrassed because we had this cloth striped belt on. It was like it had red and blue banding on it. It may very well have been a belt from the Boy Scout troop or the Cub Scouts or whatever. Because metal basically cannot go through the teleporter because of the electrostatic discharge that comes off the metal.
Yeah.
It's not sort of going to be catastrophic, but it basically creates a lot of arcing and static electricity in the vortal tunnel. Part of our training was just remembering that every time we got to Curtis Wright to remove our belt and put on an alternate, this cloth and plastic belt. But I don't remember that being part of our training when we took the jump rope to Mars. I don't remember going through any special protocol to remove my belt and hence my metal belt buckle.
Hmm.
And the other strange thing is that clearly in the case of the device, the teleporter at Curtis Wright, in contrast distinction to the jump room at Mars, nothing went with us when we were jumping between New Jersey and New Mexico. And similarly, when we jumped to the future from the Cerrillos Cultural Center site in Cerrillos, New Mexico, where they built this huge sort of black anvil-shaped Stargate. And that was in collaboration with project members in the year 2045. That also didn't involve, when we jumped through this sort of neon blue doorway that was notched in the bottom of that we would run up a ramp that had this no-stick black rubber surface on it, and we would run through that neon light in a portal at the bottom of that huge device. There was nothing around us. We were essentially, we weren't enshrouded in anything, even protective clothing in that context. I did mention the protective clothing that was used during the Chronovisor probe to the year 2013 that took place at ITT Defense Communications on November 5th of 1971. There we were being subjected to a light field that was so dense and potentially harmful to us, physiologically speaking, that we actually had something in the nature of a spacesuit on. We had a crystal helmet and this sputter-coated sort of titanium jumpsuit and boots that had been sputter-coated with some highly reflectant metal. And see, there's the paradox there. There they were protecting us from what we were being hit by in this the dense hologram that the chronovisors were capable of generating. A light that I might add was so bright that we were trained not to look up at the crystal array, which was basically used a form of bismuth crystal to generate this dense field of light that could bend non-local events into the laboratory. That light was so bright that we were trained not to look up at it because we would become permanently blind. In fact, we were told by the little girls, who was one of our contemporaries, you know, one of our young colleagues on the project, was rendered permanently blind as a result of looking up at the crystal array when it was propagating this dense light field.
Huh.
But in the case of the jump room to Mars that I ultimately sort of was the crescendo of activities, I mean, there had been obviously an almost 10-year gap between 1972 and 1981, but presumably, because I had teleported as a child in Project Pegasus, they thought, well, here's an individual who is familiar with this experience, is going to be able to cope with it. There were several, obviously, differences with the jump room. First of all, we were enshrouded by a room that went with us. Now, what that was made of, I have no idea. Presumably, that was punched through the vortal tunnel around us. There were some strange spatial effects and sensory effects in the sense that about halfway there, it was about a 20-minute trip. And at about, I would say, from about, let's say, 8 minutes to 12 minutes, right in the center of the trip, the rectilinear dimensions of the jump room became more cylindrical, as if the jump room was being compressed into sort of this oblate shape. And we had to actually adjust our posture in the elevator in a way that you wouldn't have to do, let's say, between the first floor and the fifth floor of a Los Angeles skyscraper. We which is all that I presumed that the jump room was when we took that elevator up to the fifth floor.
Right.
So that was one exception, was we were surrounded by something, literally a box. And then also, I don't remember making any special provisions for removing, for example, by then, and at that point in my life, I had glasses. I did not have glasses as a child. In fact, I had eagle eye vision uncorrected as a child. I believe my visual cortex was probably damaged as a result of refractory light that nonetheless hit my eyes when I was, for example, in the holograms that the chronovisors were propagating when I was a child attached to Project Pegasus.
Mm.
But certainly by age 18, I think I first got glasses when I was about 17 or 18 years old. So by age 19 there in 1981, I was definitely wearing metal glasses. And unless that was one of the brief times in my youth where I had contact lenses in, which is possible, but I have no way of really verifying that now, I don't remember any special provisions when I was going through the training with Courtney Hunt to make sure that I wasn't taking metal with me.
Hmm.
So that goes to the paradox of really what they've really developed in the 10 years between when Project Pegasus was experimenting with time-space exploration and when they had this fully operational capability to reach Mars by 1981.
All right.
So I really do not remember any special provisions for removing metallic objects, and I believe I was probably wearing my glasses as well.
How is it about the energy to run these devices, either if we talk about the jump room or the chronovisor device? Is there a lot of energy involved in activating or running these devices and or machines or whatever we want to call them?
Well, in the case of the jump room, I mean, we went up to the fifth floor and interacted with that man. He probably gave that man my name. And then I said, well, where's the teleporter? Courtney said, we just came up to this floor and it's the elevator. And I said, it is? And he goes, yeah, I thought I was being put on. I thought he was kidding me. So then he said, you know, have at it, Andy. You know, we will walk back into the elevator. So I did. The doors closed. And they went up to about the eighth floor. And on the intercom, Courtney said, are you ready? And I said, yes. And he said, are you sure you're ready? Because the first time I went up there by myself. And I said, yes. And then there was another pause. And I said, light this candle, which was a line from the Mercury space launches. It was one of the Mercury astronauts, I think Alan Shepard might have said.
Hmm.
So I was growing impatient. He said, Courtney, light this candle. And he laughed in that sort of derisive, cynical way that a lot of career CIA people do. You know, he was a type. He was a cigarette-smoking man from the CIA, right? But I don't know what power sources were going to that building. Certainly, in that area of West Los Angeles, there would certainly be the ability to run lines to provide a vast amount of electricity to that building. I mean, because you have power plants, primarily oil-burning power plants in the South Bay there, and there's so much urban infrastructure there that while I didn't see any power leading to the jump room, because it was merely the elevator that we used to reach the fifth floor, and then I got in and they put me up to about the eighth floor, and from there I went to Mars. So how that was done, I simply don't know. So there was no power cord or power source that I saw or had any training in regarding that building. I didn't even know that the elevator was how we were going to get there until we arrived at that CIA facility in El Segundo. In the case of the teleporter, however, at Curtis Wright in the late 60s, early 70s there when we were jumping to New Mexico, and also for that matter the one at the Sandia campus in New Mexico, there was a power cord leading from the right part of the teleport. In other words, you had these two gray parentheses-shaped objects on the floor. They were sort of freestanding on their own base, just like a somewhat exotically shaped stereo speaker, where you've got this curvilinear speaker, and then you've got this sort of modern design base that it just kind of flows into, and it stands upright like a sculpture.
Mm.
Now, the armature of the teleport on the left had a small cord leading from its base to a station where a technician sat at a rudimentary computer. He had a keyboard and some kind of screen. The other armature, the armature on the right, however, was attached to a power cord that was maybe about four times larger than you would use to plug in a vacuum cleaner, just conventional everyday living.
Mm.
It was clearly a larger power cord, but it was by no means a gargantuan power source of some kind. Now, when I did talk to Captain Lewis Wherry, who was the Navy engineer who was working under Admiral Rickover and happened to see the teleport device at Curtis Wright, he's one of the sources that I was able to develop during my 10 years of research, who saw the device. And indeed, he was an expert witness because he was directing 1,500 people in designing and manufacturing the cooling system for a whole class of U.S. nuclear submarines. So he was reporting to a reporting officer who, in turn, was just passing along his information to Admiral Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear Navy, and indeed the Navy officer who founded Project Talent in the late 1950s, because he was concerned about the caliber of plebes that he was getting at the Naval Academy and his ability to turn them into well-trained and responsible nuclear submarine captains. And that project, in fact, gave rise to the involvement of children like myself in both special enrichment programs for gifted and talented students under the aegis of the United States Navy, and also the decision to involve them in classified defense projects where they would be experiencers in the emergence of new technologies with a view to either going on and becoming Navy officers, or in my case, part of the Corps of Chrononauts that would exist in the future, and also was just being done as a general enrichment program for gifted kids in the Cold War context. Captain Wherry, who's an engineer, he's licensed as a professional engineer in California and in New Jersey, he stated that perhaps the tokamak fusion lab at Princeton was generating a massive amount of energy that you would need to teleport somebody between Woodridge, New Jersey, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. But I kind of doubt that, because presumably the energy you would be providing to that facility there at Woodridge, New Jersey, would have to be decanted to the teleport device itself, right? Mm-hmm. And the cord indicated that it wasn't that much more power than would power any conventional appliance at the household level, much less the industrial level. It was clearly within the lower industrial level of energy supply to the device.
Well, go ahead.
Well, no. So I think the key is that whatever Nikola Tesla developed between his initial experimentation with teleportation when he was at Colorado Springs, Colorado in 1899 until his death in 1943, whatever he had discovered that found its way into his papers that were then seized by those two War Department officials immediately upon his death at the Knickerbocker Hotel there in Manhattan and then passed along to the Los Alamos physicists, where they remain. I mean, a key part of my whole account, and I think something of value that I'm offering to this discussion, the discussion of the emergence of time travel technology by the U.S. government, is that Nikola Tesla's papers were never lost. They were passed along to the Los Alamos physics community.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is that he discovered, where you could literally design a solid-state device that would then tap this radiant energy that was Jack Pruitt had mentioned when we were being trained on the teleporter at Curtis Wright in Woodridge, that this device by Tesla allowed the derivation of energy that was latent in the universe, this radiant energy that's always there, that has among its capacity the characteristics, the ability to bend the fabric of time-space. Whatever that technical capability is that Tesla rendered as a solid-state appliance, apparently doesn't require that much of an input of energy into the device to literally use that energy to open up a vortal tunnel in time-space, which I think is remarkable.
Yes.
I do not believe it was a high level of applied quantum physics, but I do not believe that it was a high level of input of electricity to power the device.
Got you. And speaking about Tesla, there was another question coming in here regarding to that. Simply, was Tesla wrong in keeping some of his most dangerous inventions secret? And just as you said, then that doesn't really matter in one sense, because the CIA might have got their hands on this later on anyway, so to speak. But if not, what good can possibly come out of something that mankind is not ready to handle now? That was the question.
I think I'm certainly not an expert on Tesla's life or the decisions he made, but I suspect, based on the facts that we have, that he was secreting his really breakthrough inventions that really will constitute sort of the infrastructure, the global infrastructure of the 21st century. I think he was probably in all likelihood hiding his most advanced developments to keep them away from the war industry, because we know he had been exploited in that death ray project. Some have conjectured that the 1907 blast at Tunguska in the former Soviet Union in Siberia was the result of energy that Tesla arced over the North Pole in a death ray experiment. Clearly, Tesla was one of the several Leonardos in the history of not just Western civilization, but the human civilization on Earth. And I think he was a very advanced soul and clearly, literally an epical genius on the level of a Leonardo da Vinci. And my guess is, it's only a surmise, but my surmise is that he was hiding his most advanced technologies because he didn't want them to be captured by any military of the world and exploited for their war-making potentials. And in fact, unfortunately, that's part of the tragedy of this. In a sense, I feel that I'm a kindred spirit with Tesla because I'm waging this truth campaign so that Nikola Tesla's technologies can be freed from where they're sequestered in the military-industrial intelligence complex in the United States,
right,
and be used to advantage all of humanity. So I kind of feel this spiritual linkage to Tesla because, unfortunately, it looks like he was hiding his most advanced work that he was undertaking in the last 15 years of his life. And if you look at how frequently he was seen in public feeding his pigeons and so forth, I think he was doing that intentionally to conceal his work. But we know that the U.S. government was aware, different agencies of the U.S. government were aware of the advanced nature of his work, and that he hadn't retired or lost his mind or become, involved extensively in raising pigeons, because two different teams were sent there, the FBI team and then the War Department team. So they knew that Tesla was still working on things that they still didn't have access to.
Yeah.
So I think that he was probably hiding behind a veneer of as if he had aged and had sort of lost his mind or become addled and was just simply absorbed with his pigeons. He may have very well been absorbed with raising pigeons as pets, just as a diversion, but we know he was engrossed in very profound research and development activities, but that unfortunately these devices were then weaponized and they've been sequestered at the Los Alamos National Labs since Tesla's death in the mid-40s.
Right, so ultimately it doesn't really have to do with him, so to speak, a lot of the consequent discoveries that were made. They were just based on what Tesla discovered, and as you say, these technologies have consequently been weaponized and used by the military. Is that right?
Well, yes, some of them have been used. We know that the hologram technology from the chronovisors that are being Gemelli developed, we have a statement by Captain Ernest Garcia, who was the Army Security Attaché to Project Pegasus, and was helping me in my research in early 2010. He gave me a lot of valuable information. He stated that we used holography to deceive Saddam Hussein's regime, that we were invading Baghdad with literally thousands of tanks during the invasion of Baghdad during the Iraq War after the bombardment there.
Yes.
Going back to Tesla, I don't think that Tesla was keeping his leading technologies from humanity. I think he was trying to protect them from the military industrial complex on behalf of humanity. And unfortunately, he knew what he was doing was the emergent technology of the next 100 years. And yet he had to continue to develop it, but at the same time he had to hide it from them. But they ended up getting it anyway. So I don't think the onus for that can be laid at the feet of Nikola Tesla.
Right.
I think that we can lay that at the feet of the U.S. Department of Defense, essentially usurping Tesla's technologies and consequently putting us in a situation where we may have to deploy these technologies ultimately on an emergency basis, rather than having them gradually introduced into our global infrastructure. So I think the onus really we can lay at the feet of the military industrial complex in the United States. And I suspect that Tesla was actually trying to protect his devices from the U.S. government and probably trying to find a way to see if he could have them deployed globally without them being first weaponized. But unfortunately, they were weaponized, and they've been sequestered ever since at Los Alamos.
Hmm.
And that's the true history of U.S. time travel research, is essentially the sequestration of Tesla's cutting edge technologies, and so the time space age was essentially stillborn, and I'm trying to revive it and bring it back to life so that, for example, we can jump between major metropolitan hubs at different world cities, and then take all those airplanes out of the sky and all the greenhouse gases that we're emitting just in conventional, commercial airline flights.
And it would be more comfortable than to sit in an airplane for 16 or 20 or whatever, how many hours it is as well. So why not, huh?
Yeah, well, think of, London to Sydney. That's a 24-hour flight.
There,
imagine
exactly.
That lasting several seconds rather than 24 hours.
Exactly. Another one simply wanted to know if you had foreknowledge about 9/11 or not.
I did, but, when I discuss what I had foreknowledge of, people become confused and they think, well, he was a kid on this project, so he brought all these data points forward. He must have been talking about them. He must have been waiting for the individual that had been identified as future president of the United States, for example, to get elected. It really wasn't like that. I mean, if you think of how many people you meet and how many bits of information you process just in one day, it was different than that. I basically had a set of exposures to future information, and it was only after those events happened that I was able to say, oh, I remember hearing about that when I was on Project Pegasus. I wasn't living my life in anticipation that a certain set of political events, for example, were destined to occur. I simply had foreknowledge of them and pretty much forgot them. But then they were revived in my memory as a result of those events then happening. Now, people will say, well, that's a threat to validity. You're just saying something that happened, you knew it was going to happen. Well, unfortunately, that's what happened. I mean, I heard about certain people becoming president. I heard about certain major events. And I saw some data from the future that I did carry forward, but I was only able to correlate it when those events then happened. Because, I mean, I didn't even start looking into what happened to me on Project Pegasus until I was 37 and a half years old. So we're talking about, in some cases, well, certainly in the early Pegasus material itself, when I was a kid on the project, we're talking about me reaching back 35 years, now 40
yeah.
years,
yeah.
to remembering what I did. Now, try to think of something that you did on a Tuesday afternoon when you were 7 years old. I mean, please. I can only remember this stuff because I did such memory work over the last 10 years, trying to map the people, the places, the events, and those scant data points that I recovered when I was on the project of what the future held. Now, among those, the 9/11 event was very conspicuous, and it was conspicuous for two reasons in terms of foreknowledge of the event. The first is that on a social level, when I was sharing meals, for example, in the restaurants in Old Town Albuquerque with my dad and other people on the project, these would be engineers from the Ralph M. Parsons Company. They would be federal science administrators like Dr. Harold M. Agnew when he was the director. By 1970, he was then the director of the Los Alamos Labs. They might involve somebody from the CIA. I remember we took several meals with Dr. Ivan Browning when he was the director of science and technology at CIA. There might be a consulting engineer from General Electric like Bob Beckwith at the lunch table. There might be a Manhattan Project scientist like Dr. Edward Teller who was present at some meals that we took. And also they were attending every once in a while a political person who was destined for a career of substantial magnitude in the United States would also be one of the people who was a guest at the lunch table there when the Project Pegasus engineers shared meals together. They favored the La Hacienda and La Placida restaurants in Old Town Albuquerque, New Mexico, because at that time those were the oldest and the most renowned restaurants that served Mexican food in the whole state of New Mexico. So those were sort of significant restaurants to take guests, for example. Let's say a consulting engineer from another state was coming through and you just wanted to treat this person to a special lunch in New Mexico. Well, we would drive down from Santa Fe or Los Alamos or wherever we were and share lunch, let's say, at the La Hacienda with that person. So there were many, many meals that I shared with not just my father, but with the project engineers and administrators and guests during those 3 years when I was on the project. During several of those social functions, most of them in Albuquerque, there were discussions about things that they knew were going to take place in the future. And actually, before I get into 9/11, let me just mention what I remember being discussed.
Mm-hmm.
9/11 was clearly discussed. The Clinton presidency was referenced several times. They knew that this young man named Bill Clinton was going to be elected president and that he was going to have two terms that were going to be very successful. And we now know that Bill Clinton was essentially the most successful American president of the 20th century. He was the only president since FDR, for example, to leave a surplus when he left office. So they knew about this generational change agent president named President Bill Clinton. There was also a reference to the advent of a disease that when people had sexual intercourse, they could spread a fatal disease to each other. And that wasn't referenced as AIDS, but they were clearly talking about AIDS but didn't know what it was being called. Or at least when they engaged in the shop talk, when they had read about it in one of the intelligence reports, they wouldn't be talking about what they read, which was acquired immune deficiency syndrome. They would just be telling somebody, yeah, I read in one of the reports that there's going to be this venereal disease that can kill you. Okay, it was sort of like that. And there was also a reference to the advent of the Internet. In fact, there was a discussion between John McCone of the CIA. Now, John McCone had worked with Ralph M. Parsons as essentially lieutenants to Stephen Bechtel during World War II, when Bechtel took, I think it was $100,000 and parlayed it into a $50 million fortune building Liberty ships for the U.S. Navy during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Well, John McCone went into a career with the CIA, and it was the CIA that Project Pegasus was gathering intelligence about past and future events for. And then Ralph M. Parsons, of course, was my father's employer. In fact, I met Ralph Parsons at his office in New York during one of the trips with my dad when we were back, when Parsons was still on Wall Street in New York City, and my dad and I were back in New York on a project basis when I should have been in school, but I was actually out in New Jersey, but I was actually out in downtown New York with my father. I remember one visit to Ralph M. Parsons' personal office there at the Ralph M. Parsons Company. So there was a discussion with John McCone and my father and several other project engineers, and he was describing what the Internet would be. He was saying, let me describe it. Basically, the individual sitting at this device that looks like a synthesis of a television screen and a typewriter, and through that device, through a cable that runs from that device to an electrical grid or whatever, they can communicate with written messages with anybody wherever they are in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And my father really couldn't grasp what he was describing. And he got up from the table. This is actually going to be one of the sort of comedic scenes in the feature film about my experiences. My dad said, yeah, I know, but I'm still disturbed by this phrase .com. Maybe it means the commies have taken over by then.
That's a good one, yeah.
I think that kind of describes the fact. These were ordinary Americans, some of them obviously just ordinary engineers working for a defense contractor like my dad. Some of them were obviously luminaries of their time in the intelligence community or in science, in quantum physics. But they were still human beings like us who were reading intelligence reports in which past and future events were being described, and they were just trying to synthesize that information with their existing worldview. So they didn't have this omniscient grasp of everything that was going to happen in the future. In fact, they had technicians sitting in these facilities essentially compiling information that they couldn't even analyze about, for example, past events. For example, when we went to that National Security Watch post in Flemington, New Jersey, where I was shown about an 8-inch circular screen that was depicting actual images of Washington and Franklin at the signing of the U.S. Constitution in Philadelphia on September 17th of 1787. The technicians there were compiling 16-millimeter film, basically documentary film footage, of all of the hologram emissions that were being propagated and just storing it in film canisters. And so it was in that context that Project Pegasus was mapping the future. It was clearly an incomplete mapping because the only thing about the past or future that was notable that somebody like my father would have known as a result of reading the intelligence reports were the key points in those reports. There were things that they were recording, for example, with the chronovisors that probably intelligence analysts never even analyzed.
Do you think that, just to interject there, do you think that primarily then just was because of the fact that the military was just interested in a certain type of information related to, I don't know, internal security or what's going to happen in the future so we can prevent it from happening? So it's run like a military program for other purposes than we might think of it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I know based on what we were what I know based on the educational curriculum that we received in the program, namely the training we received, and certainly this was also reiterated by the project engineers on a social level when I was in their company, for example, in Albuquerque, there had been a decision, both an executive decision and then also there was a consensus on the project, that the project should be used to gather intelligence to allow the federal government of the United States to engage in contingency planning regarding future events, but not play God and try to divert the course of human destiny.
Right.
So they clearly had specific intelligence objectives. For example, during that probe to the future to 2013 that we undertook when we had to wear the protective clothing at ITT Defense, and according to my father, we literally disappeared from the stage when they turned the light on. He thought we had been destroyed. You know, he thought we had been obliterated by the light. He had to go into another room and compose himself. And when we reappeared and I was walked off the stage so I could be debriefed by a naval intelligence officer, my dad had tears in his eyes. He'd been crying because he thought we had been killed. Okay. So in that case, they had a specific target, which is what is going to be the condition of the U.S. Supreme Court building in 2013. Okay, so and that's where we saw the Supreme Court building under about 100 feet of brackish water. Okay, so some
really?
Involve specific intelligence objectives.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but my point is that when they were using these different forms of quantum access, for example, when they were propagating holograms in New Jersey and having these dour technicians in white lab coats film everything, that stuff was just being thrown in canisters. I don't know how extensive the analysis of that data was. Similarly, when we were retrieving microfilm summaries of future events, when we were jumping through the Stargate at Cerritos and arriving there at that office building in the year 2045 and going inside and being given small little canisters of microfilm and then ferrying them back through a teleport there, popping back into view in 1972 in the grounds immediately around the microwave tower at the Lobo Overlook site in southwestern Colorado, which is due west of the Continental Divide sign there on Highway 160. We were bringing a substantial amount of data back, and I don't know whether intelligence analysts were going over every frame of that. So that's kind of the backdrop for describing what I actually saw of 9/11. I think that creates the context of what I'm saying. They were gathering a lot of data about the past and future. And I'm not certain whether they were actually identifying discrete data points when they were just doing sort of this gross harvesting of data. Clearly, some specific intelligence objectives where they wanted an answer to one question, like what's the condition of the U.S. Capitol, you know, in 2013.
Right.
But at other times it seemed that they were just gathering data. Presumably, it's been analyzed by them. So what happened was we were at the La Hacienda restaurant. My dad had a personal friend there that off and on, it seems, in his life he had been romantically involved with. He clearly had been romantically involved with Connie Chavez. When he first went out to New Mexico in 1953-54 for Curtis Wright to flight test the ramjet engine. And those activities were undertaken clearly in the post-July 1952, you know, extraterrestrial defense posture, right? Because it was in October of 1952, after that famous overflight of Washington, D.C., by 9 flying saucers clocked at traveling over 7,000 miles per hour by the air traffic control at the Langley Air Force Base, that my father was literally given military orders to report to Curtis Wright to work on the ramjet. So when they were then flight testing the ramjet, when they had it built by 1953-54, he met this beautiful Spanish-American waitress named Mary Constance Chavez, who was a native Albuquerque, in fact, lived in Albuquerque her whole life, dying there in January of 1981 at age 52. Okay, so I was describing the fact that, you know, Connie Chavez was this love interest in my dad's life, and that went back 20 years before I was even on Project Pegasus as a kid, or almost 20 years. And we were in a situation where we were 2,000 miles from home. And my dad spent 8 years in quantum displacement in New Mexico. By that I mean he was doing this defense work in New Mexico where he would teleport from Curtis Wright and do things there for months and years and then teleport back to the day he left in New Jersey. I was also being sent on similar time loops, but not for as much elapsed time in New Mexico. I just turned 48 chronologically speaking. But biologically, I'm about 49, because when we sat down and figured out how much time I spent in New Mexico, it was about an extra year. But my dad spent 8 extra years there. So when he died at age 66 in 1990, biologically, he was actually 74.
Hmm.
And certainly by 1972, when my father was 49 and my mother was 47, my mom looked 45 and dad looked 65. I mean, his hair was completely white, and he looked, you know, in his 60s rather than his 40s. Okay. And so, in order to just sort of survive psychologically there, we had to act like everything was normal. In other words, that we're having a normal set of experiences, but we weren't. We were not only in quantum displacement, essentially on another timeline from our ordinary life in New Jersey, but in that context, we were being involved in non-ordinary experiences. So our social connections in New Mexico were very precious to us. And we would go by and just sit around the restaurant just because Connie was there, because she was, you know, she was that human touch outside of all of the strange things we were involved in, which often were very stressful. For example, I was being immersed in different events in the past, and I was always concerned that I would not be able to be returned from them. You know, so Connie was really a sort of a signal personality. You know, she was a critical person in our life during those years. So whenever we had any downtime, we were frequently going over to a restaurant, maybe having lunch, and hanging around with her for a couple hours. But during one of those days when we were just simply there at the restaurant, my dad received a phone call. Now, she was also a support person for the project. For example, the project records that were a log of people who were being signed in as having teleported to Mexico, containing their name and their date and time of arrival in New Mexico, were actually being kept behind the counter by Connie at the La Hacienda restaurant. So individuals who know New Mexico and remember the restaurant, it's still there. It may be torn down at some point, but the La Hacienda is literally one of the most famous restaurants in all of New Mexico. And so people who were there in the early 70s, who are among your listeners, now know that literally the logs that were being kept to record the teleportees that were jumping into New Mexico during those years were being kept by Connie Chavez behind the counter at the La Hacienda restaurant.
Huh.
Okay, so she was also a support person for the project, not just my dad's former love interest.
Hmm.
So one day she turned the phone there at the restaurant over to my father and said, okay, I'll be right down. We get in the rental car he had there. The federal provided vehicle that just as being on a defense project. And we sped down Highway I-25 south from Albuquerque to Socorro, New Mexico. We would then make a right and go west on Bullock Avenue, because in those years, right on the grounds of what is now, in front of what is now the research library at New Mexico Tech. New Mexico Tech is the New Mexico Institute of Mining Science and Technology, something like this. But in those years, there was a small building about the size of an Albuquerque insurance company building. It was a C-shaped building. It had a black macadam parking lot in front of it that accommodated about 8 to 10 vehicles. In the front left corner of the property there, at the intersection of Bullock Avenue and Leroy Place, where there's a Masonic temple of all things. Actually, one of the coincidences is that Masonic temple was established there the year of my birth, 1961, according to its plaque. But there in the front of the property was a black granite sign that in broad silver lettering said Aerojet Corporation. Now, when I went on my second fact-finding trip with my friend here from Vancouver, Washington, Dixie Karras, in September of 2004, before we left Vancouver, Washington to go on that second fact-finding trip, I wrote Aerojet on their corporate website, and they said, thank you for your inquiry, but we can confirm that Aerojet did not have a corporate presence in Socorro, New Mexico until 1985.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then Dixie and I went on that trip. That was the trip when we found, literally, we were there 8 days, and every day I found one of the project locations. It was almost as if, as I write in the book, it was as if you know, the ground of New Mexico was opening up its time travel secrets. And so we went to the New Mexico Tech Research Library there, and we spoke with Joy Thompson. Now, Joy was is a wonderful woman. I don't know if she has yet passed away, but she told us she was suffering from a terminal illness, like a form of cancer that she had as a result of growing up and even playing in radioactive locations as a child, you know, as a native New Mexican. And so she was most eager to help us because I explained how I had been a child on a defense-related research and development project there in New Mexico, and I myself had been subjected to harmful energy fields, and I was worried about my own health because, for example, I developed keloid scarring all over my chest, shoulders, and back the year after I left Pegasus. My skin actually opened up, as it sometimes does with radiation. My dad had been giving me shots of vanadium in the basement as a young child before all these defense project activities were undertaken. And when I asked him why you're giving me these shots, he said, to protect your teeth and bones from radiation. So those administering Project Pegasus knew that there were potentially harmful energy fields that we would encounter and that might compromise our health.
Right.
But anyway, Joy, you know, Joy was one of those victims of Defense Department activity in New Mexico. And she said, sure, I'll help you. Let's spend the whole afternoon on this. We went into her archives, and everybody working there, whether they had grown up in Socorro or Los Alamos or Santa Fe or Albuquerque, they all remembered that Aerojet building there. They all confirmed. Yes, you described exactly what was there in the early 70s, Andy. It was a C-shaped building. There was a zero-scaped courtyard in the front with some cacti in it. There was the parking lot you've described. We remember the sign. Now, what I remember is that when we would walk into the front of the building through the middle of the C, we would come to the security desk, and the whole left side of the building was walled off with these shiny stainless steel bars, like in a prison. In other words, the left side was blocked by this cage-like contraption that the security officer with a badge, he was a federal security marshal, my father would show his identification. He would say, my son's with me, and we would go into the left side of that building. So on this particular day, my dad literally sped at 90 to 100 miles per hour down Highway I-25. So we got there in about an hour rather than an hour and a half. I think it's about 90 miles south of Albuquerque, maybe even less than an hour. And my dad was literally chomping at the bit as we went through security there. And after we got on the other side of that cage, the cage was open and we got inside that left side of the building. One of the technicians comes up to my dad, just like in one of these feature films where, you know, the Earth is going to be bombarded by asteroids from space, or, you know, they've discovered a monolith on the moon or something. Now, this character actor type engineer comes up to my dad with his security badge swinging. You know, he quickly walks up to my dad. He says, Ray, you're not going to believe it. We've got it. We've got images of the event. Now, he took us into a room that was nothing but a bank of multiple TV screens. There must have been 20 TV monitors in that room. And they popped something, and I don't know whether it was like a Betamax tape or something more sophisticated, but they popped something into a video player device of some kind. And what happened was the screen sort of pixelated digitally into a full image that showed one of the planes hitting one of the Twin Towers in 2001 and erupting in a fireball, and then it basically pixelated out and you had a blank screen again. In other words, it was about a 20-second digital fragmented image from an angle that we didn't see in any of the 9/11 conventional videotapes. It was sort of from the middle of the sky. It was as if somebody had been, let's say, oh, I don't know, 1,000 feet from the top of one of the buildings as one of the planes came in and collided and created a huge fireball. Now, that event, the 9/11 event, was also discussed in the social context that I've described. When, for example, we were taking lunch with the project engineers, there was a conversation I remember between my father and one of the other guys from Parsons, and he said, Ray, what is this 9/11 event everybody's talking about? I understand it's some kind of domestic Pearl Harbor. Is it serious? And my dad said, yep. And he goes, well, what happened? And he goes, my dad then gave the conventional explanation for 9/11. He said, Middle Eastern terrorists hijacked several commercial airliners. They slammed them into the Twin Towers that they're building in New York City. And the guy goes, well, what happens next? And he says, the buildings come down like a ton of bricks. And the guy's going, really? Right in the middle of downtown New York? My God, that's awful. He goes, what happens next? And my dad said, the country recovers, picks itself up, dusts itself off, and goes on like nothing happened. Okay, so my father had a basic conventional understanding of 9/11, just as if he was alive in our time when 9/11 happened, and could gather just an everyday man's understanding of what 9/11 was, as you would read it like in a conventional Wikipedia entry or news account of it,
right,
without any deep political insight. So that convinces me that he would have had read of it in the intelligence reports that, for example, were being promulgated from the microfilm summaries of future events, that we would be going to the future and taking back. So what I'm saying is I believe what entered the intelligence reports that were being circulated by the principals of Project Pegasus, people like Donald Rumsfeld, would have been just a conventional telling of the 9/11 event.
Right.
So, but the event was discussed in front of me. So when I was doing my research during and after the event, I was mindful that was one of the data points. That was one of the data points that had been, you know, sort of serendipitously shared with me when I was on the project. It certainly didn't enter any of our specialized schooling. I only had prior knowledge of it because it had been spoken of in my presence, and because I simply happened to be in my father's company when he was summoned down to Socorro to view that image.
At that point, did you or your father feel that it was, or rather, were you in a position where you could talk to someone about this, or write it down for future reference, or get the word out to help people that was, you know, that got killed in the event, or what was the relationship there, so to speak, to the information? Was like, yes, this is real, it's going to happen. Can we prevent it? Can we warn someone? Or did you and your dad have the approach that no, we can't step in, or we can't talk to someone about this?
Well, there was certainly no urgency among the project people to do anything to act upon the information that they were privy to. For example, when you're in law enforcement and you're, let's say, investigating a murder case, and you find that somebody is doing something with their life that's destructive or something, you basically have sort of this hands-off attitude. You know, if I'm investigating a first-degree murder case, I'm not going to worry if somebody has an alcohol addiction that I meet during my investigation. In other words, there was a sort of a sanctity issue where there was this institutional and also institutional decision, and also sort of this consensus among the people directly involved in the project, like my father, that they would not engage in quantum engineering. In fact, the subject of, when I asked at the lunch table one time why an engineering company like Ralph M. Parsons was involved in this time travel project, my dad tried to explain that Parsons was one of the world's largest process engineering companies and did a lot of defense work for the government. But then Bob Beckwith chimed in and said, Andy, that's because someday we want to be involved in quantum engineering. And I said, what's that? And he said, actually changing the future for the better based on studying the potentialities that could occur. And everybody at the table actually scowled. They almost groaned with derision for that assertion by Mr. Beckwith. He was clearly in the minority among the project people. The conventional wisdom, the consensus among all the people in the project was that they would gather information about future events and engage in contingency planning, but not alter the events. And as I think I mentioned on our first broadcast, there's a quantum paradox that also would cause the government to do this anyway, and that is, if you know of a big event like 9/11, and that event sends out waves of causality that influence everybody on the planet, or everybody in the developed world, let's say, in their attitudes, their beliefs, their decisions. If you then prevent that event from occurring, you diminish the intelligence value of all events that you've gotten prior knowledge of that occur after that event that you change.
Right.
You essentially alter the future in a way that causes the future that does occur to escape the ambit of your search for what the future holds. If that makes any sense.
Okay, yeah,
so,
gotcha.
So because of that paradox, clearly the decision to not intervene regarding future events, at a minimum, must have been post what we would call in the law a rule of reason. What I suspect they did is they had this bias to not alter future events because they did not want to play God, and they wanted to engage in contingency planning, and they also didn't want to alter the value of their intelligence database after they, regarding the events that would occur after they altered a specific big event that was going to occur. For example, if they had prevented 9/11 to save 3,000 human souls from perishing in that tragic event.
Yeah.
I think what they may have done is applied a rule of reason. Well, wait a minute. If it's really a super catastrophic event, like losing a major world city to an act of atomic terrorism, let's then intervene and try to catch up with our intelligence gathering regarding events after that. And that's what I think may have occurred that spurred the Iraq war. When we saw Colin Powell there being embarrassed by going in front of the UN and insisting that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, what I suspect happened is that on one alternate future that they had forward intelligence on, he did obtain weapons of mass destruction and probably used them to destroy a major city, perhaps London, Paris, New York, Washington, D.C. We really don't know where. And then we intervened to topple his regime. The United States intervened and its allies intervened to topple his regime. And then the net effect was that he didn't obtain weapons of mass destruction. But we still had the reputation of the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, being besmirched before the UN because he had asserted that we did have evidence that Saddam was seeking weapons of mass destruction. So I think they may have decided to apply what we would call in the law a rule of reason to decide when to act to prevent a specific event, but in the process jeopardize the quality of their intelligence database for all data points occurring after that event. But if I was asked, let's say, in front of the U.S. Congress tomorrow or whatever, Monday, what was it? I would say that they had made an institutional decision not to act. And that means that relative to, you know, to change a future event that they had foreknowledge of. And that means that relative to the 9/11 event, they, in all likelihood, engaged in contingency planning for it, but let it happen. Now, what is the evidence that they had foreknowledge of it? Well, we know that President George W. Bush spoke of seeing the footage during the day of the event. He spoke in terms of having footage of the first plane hitting the first tower. And unfortunately, in terms of conventional videography, those images weren't available for another day. So that could not have happened unless the U.S. presidency, unless the executive office of the president was possessed of chronovision, right? In other words, whether they could loop into his computer, you know, his laptop in his limousine, non-local images of the first plane hitting the first tower.
Yeah, yeah.
The second thing though is that the National Security Advisor, who later became Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, advised former Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco.
Yeah.
To not travel that morning. We also know that when Secretary Rumsfeld became Defense Secretary for the second time under President George W. Bush, he had his office moved to the other side of the Pentagon from where the projectile of some kind, whether it was a plane or a missile, hit the Pentagon
right.
on September 11th.
Yes.
And so forth. In other words, we had data points indicating that they knew the event was going to occur, at least was going to occur on some September 11th. They might not have had the year, and therefore they were engaging in what was indicated they would be engaging in when I was a kid on Project Pegasus, which was contingency planning for future events, but not actually quantum engineering where they were trying to change a future event. More evidence that they had prior knowledge is the way in which the Osama bin Laden was attributed as the progenitor of the event in the American mass media immediately after the event. I think on NBC, Katie Kirk and Tom Brokaw used the name Osama bin Laden something like 200 times on September 11th of 2001. So the contingency planning to blame Al-Qaeda for the event may have actually reached into the American mass media as a result of foreknowledge of the event.
Hmm.
But I believe I'm an adherent to the view that they let it happen because if they had prevented the 9/11 event, they clearly would have diminished the value of everything they knew about the future occurring after that event, because that was a hugely impacting historical event.
Well, that creates a weird kind of situation there where you know about the future, but on one hand then can't really do anything about it, so to speak, because you're interested in knowing as well what's going to happen after that event. So you end up in a kind of you know what's going to happen, but what is the information for it almost in a way, if you follow my train of thought there?
Right. So you do things like providing a contract to a television producer to put an inspirational broadcast on American television several nights after the event. You bring a FEMA team into downtown Manhattan on September 10th, which we know they did.
Mm.
You engage in contingency planning. Yeah, so it sets up a paradox. If you do nothing, you can do a maximum amount of contingency planning. But if you decide to do something that prevents the event, you then diminish your ability to do that in the future because you've changed the direction that the future takes. So, yes, it is paradoxical, but I believe that that's what happened, that they knew about the event going back 30 years. They may have even scripted things like that famous speech by George W. Bush on the rubble with the fire captain
mm-hmm.
standing next to him
mm-hmm.
with the megaphone.
Right.
You know, they may have set up even that lifting of the flag, the famous lifting of the flag by the three firemen
yep.
With the rubble behind them. So they knew that they could see from the chronovisors that, you know, this big area of downtown Manhattan had been reduced to, you know, three stories of rubble, splintered of two huge office buildings that were the biggest, you know, some of the biggest freestanding structures in the world had just been reduced to a heap of rubble in downtown Manhattan. So they clearly, I think they engaged in contingency planning. They decided to use the event to pass the Patriot Act. They sort of used it to change the worldview of the American people and sort of try to eliminate the Vietnam legacy, the cynicism and opposition to the government that had been fomented during the Vietnam crisis. And yet, I think that ultimately they had prior knowledge. That's my own belief. Because
yes.
I know, well, actually, let me address that. I know they had by prior knowledge, I know they had the information in their database. But to be fair, since these findings were being dropped into these intelligence reports, and all of us went on and lived our lives for 30 years before the event occurred, I don't know exactly what Donald Rumsfeld was thinking on September 11th of 2001. What I mean is I know they had the data. Did they have foreknowledge in the sense that they were waiting for it to happen? I don't know that. But when I say I believe that they let it happen, my suspicion is that they had immediate knowledge. They were expecting the event. And therefore, they were decided to let it happen, and they had done as much contingency planning as they could. They made sure that Rumsfeld's desk was across the Pentagon and so forth.
Mm.
But do I know, you know, to be fair to everybody who had prior knowledge based on that data entering the Defense Department archive as a result of Project Pegasus being successful in achieving quantum access by 1970? I don't know exactly what was governing their thinking on the morning of the event. I simply don't have that information.
Yeah.
And it's quite possible that that information had entered the archives and they had forgotten about it. You know, so to be fair, I don't know exactly what was governing their thinking on the morning of the event. I don't think anybody will ever know.
And it seems like in any regard that they could use, since they have the awareness of this, they could use the event to their advantage to do all the things that you obviously mentioned, to do create almost kind of a theatric little theater around this event, so to speak, in order to propel the nation into going into another war and so forth. We don't know that either, but that seems to be the case in any regard if we consequently look at what has happened. Andrew,
yeah,
I have two more points or comments rather here that I want to touch upon it. And if we can, we can try to keep it brief, and then we can move on. We can take a little break at that point and then move on to talk about Mars, okay?
Okay, great.
So one thing was actually about Bill Richardson. Another one wrote here that Bill Richardson is actually a blue-blood Yankee. He grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, and did not move to New Mexico until late 1978, during the time that Bushago claimed he was checking time travels in the New Mexico State House. Bill Richardson was playing amateur baseball. It's a fact because there are actually statistics available for this. Is that a time discrepancy, and any comments on that?
All I can do is tell what I know, and the individual who was taking roll for us when we were telecording to the Santa Fe State Capitol grounds in the summer of 1970 was Bill Richardson, and he was the Bill Richardson who became governor of New Mexico, because on a project level, his destiny as governor was discussed. And it was also the same Bill Richardson, because I met with Governor Richardson in June of 2003. Under the pretext of him going up to the old car show, the antique car show in Chama, New Mexico. And you can check online and see that there was an antique car show in Chama in June of 2003. Okay. It was the same Bill Richardson. Now, I have stated in previous interviews and among my research associates, and it's going to be described in my book, that Bill Richardson was not from New Mexico, that he in fact moved there and pursued a political career there, first becoming the congressman from the 3rd District, where the labs are, okay, in the late 1970s. But the person who was taking roll when we would teleport to Santa Fe was a recent college grad from Boston named Bill Richardson. So my point is I've never established that Bill Richardson or asserted that Bill Richardson is a native New Mexican. In fact, in previous interviews, I've stated that it was, in fact, his involvement in Project Pegasus as a recent college grad that caused him to be in New Mexico, and I believe he returned to New Mexico to run for Congress from the 3rd District and literally be the congressman for the atomic labs as a result of his earlier involvement in Project Pegasus in the early 1970s. Now, what my research into his career showed is that shortly after college, or in it was either the summer before his senior year at Tufts or what his first job, official job in government, was for a Republican congressman in that summer. So in the same way that Donald Rumsfeld, a Republican, was ostensibly working for the Board of Wage and Price Stabilization for President Nixon, I believe that when a young Bill Richardson, as a recent college grad, was working for a Republican congressman, supposedly in Washington, D.C., he was actually out in New Mexico working on Project Pegasus as a young staffer. So this particular listener's data is incorrect. Bill Richardson was not playing baseball in the summer of 1970. He was working for a Republican congressman, and I believe that was probably being used as a cover to permit him to work secretly on Project Pegasus in the same way that Secretary Rumsfeld's appointment to President Nixon's Board of Wage and Price Stabilization was being used to conceal his project activity. So I stand by my account. I know it was the Bill Richardson because I asked him his name when he was taking roll. They were marching us into this room in the Bataan Memorial Building, and we would sit at this little chair with a desk on it across from Bill Richardson. And he would ask our name first and last and have us spell our last name. And in the case of my surname, which is certainly an unusual surname, not just in the United States, but around the world, he had me pronounce and spell my surname. And then I leaned forward and asked him what his name was. And he said, Bill. And I said, Bill what? And he said, Richardson. So I discerned his identity when I was a child on the project. I was then present at a lunch that was taken in Albuquerque where there was chuckling around the table. There was, you know, a spattering of laughter around the table when they had my book and they said, and you know Bill, the young staffer that's taking role when the kids teleport to Santa Fe, he becomes governor. Okay, so they were actually laughing about the fact that this young staffer was destined to become governor of the state that the project was in. And then I had my own personal meeting with Richardson. The Bill Richardson data point is well established, and I, in fact, going to be making a public appeal to urge Secretary Rumsfeld and Governor Richardson, one a prominent Republican, the other a prominent Democrat, both of whom have either run for U.S. president or been spoken of as potential candidates, in the case of Mr. Rumsfeld, to come forward and confirm that the U.S. achieved teleportation by no later than 1967-68. So I stand by my claim, and I don't find evidence that he was a baseball player that summer. He was working for a Republican congressman, supposedly working for a Republican congressman.
All righty. Okay, well, we have one more comment here then, and this is quite a fun one, actually. See if you have any comments on this. It says, I listened many times to your show with Andrew D. Bishago, which spurred me to find more about Mr. Bishago. I came across a 6-hour interview with him on YouTube, and his voice is clearly and unequivocally David Wilcox of Divine Cosmos. If you play your interview and the interview on YouTube, there is no match. And if you play David's voice and the YouTube video, there is no doubt about it. They are the same. Intonation, tone, everything. Why are they perpetrating this obvious hoax? I actually searched for this myself and found a long forum post about this as well. Have you seen this? Any comments on this at all?
An urban legend has been created that I'm David Wilcox. I'm not. I would hope that both of us would be flattered by the assertion that we're the same person. I certainly hold David in high esteem.
Yeah.
I view him as an ally and a friend. He's one of my Facebook friends. We don't know each other, but I'm sure at some point we'll appear together. I suspect that this is either simply foolishness or it may be a disinformational ploy targeted at me, because I'm possessed of some ego because, for example, I spent many years earning different academic qualifications so they could read my profile and see that I probably have some ego. I think that I'm a fairly headstrong person in the way I come off when I practice law and also when I appear publicly in regard to my truth campaign. So I've conjectured that maybe this is a way to try to undermine my truth campaign by suggesting that I'm a younger person who perhaps I would be offended in some way being compared to somebody else. Maybe they think I'm a truly egotistical person. I don't know. But I suspect that if you look at the fora where this assertion has been made, this seems to be a disinformational ploy of some kind. And that's all I'd really like to say about it.
Right.
I'm not David Wilcock.
Mm.
I've never met him. We certainly have common friends, for example, in Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy at Project Camelot. We're talking about similar things in the sense that he's done a lot of interesting interviews in applied quantum physics. I'm describing experiences in applied quantum physics that I had both as a child in Project Pegasus and on the several teleportings to Mars. He's also addressed the fact that David has stated that there are 600,000 U.S. personnel on Mars. I don't doubt it because I was up there 28 years ago, and there were already staff members up there. Team members of the CIA presence on Mars rather than the NASA presence. But I'm not David Wilcock. I'm not offended by the assertion that I am. And I don't know what else to say. I mean, there are some, there's a YouTube that was published, that was produced out of Australia, that's labeled with my name and PIA 10214, which is the NASA image that I analyze in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars. And I think there's an attempt in that YouTube to make the rather crass person wearing a T-shirt in the production maybe confuse viewers that person is me because they've labeled the YouTube with my name. And he goes into this theory that I'm actually David Wilcock. But unfortunately, David Wilcock crossed my field of vision when I was when my story was under consideration to become a TV drama by one of the major TV networks in the United States. I don't want to say which one it was. And the producer of that series that we were developing mentioned David Wilcock to me and urged me to view his Project Camelot interviews. And then there have been several other times when I've listened to David on Coast to Coast. I think he's a very brilliant individual, and hopefully he and I will be able to collaborate during public appearances in the future. But we have no connection. I don't know anything about him besides the fact that he's. He's a young physicist with a lot to say about applied quantum physics, and I believe that we're kindred spirits in the sense that we're attempting to create a discourse in which the infrastructure of the 21st century will be articulated, but beyond that, there's no connection between us. I've never met him. I don't know any of anybody representing him. We've had no discussions, and the only thing I can figure about the difference between the YouTube, 6-hour YouTube interview that Jessica Schaub of Vancouver, British Columbia did and my other radio interviews is that was the only one that was done via Skype. So maybe the audio recognition system in Skype somehow altered my voice a little bit and made it sound more like David's. But
it sounded like
I'm not David Wilcock.
It sounded like a speakerphone, Andrew, to me when I listened a little bit to that YouTube clip. We're recording you through Skype here as well, and it sounds a little bit different. That's all I can say. And it sounds like it's some kind of modulation or something going on there. It did sound different to me, though, but it does not sound as David Wilcock to me. That's another thing I want to mention.
Yeah.
About.
I'm trying to think of a line for this particular question. I'm not David Wilcock, and I'm also not Amelia Earhart or Judge Crater.
Anyway, Andrew, we just wanted to clear that off the table. It was a question that came in, and I thought it would be good of you to address it if it's out there, so people
sure.
know what's going on there. But all yeah, right. Oh yeah. Do you want to say something more about it, Andrew? Or?
Well, no. I'm just saying that's a good urban legend to knock down because,
in fact,
David and I are two figures in this field, and presumably we'll be working at least on the level of appearing at conferences together. So I guess it's going to be a running joke at that point once it's affirmed that we're literally ontologically two different human beings.
So, okay. All right. Well, okay. Thanks for that, Andrew. Thanks for taking those questions and for your comments, obviously. Why don't we take a little break here right then and then finally go into some of the Mars material when we return. But do you want to mention any of your websites or anything like that as we round things up here for the first segment, Andrew?
Sure. Alfred Lambermont Weber, one of our most distinguished, arguably our most distinguished exopolitical theorist, was quite gracious in being a strategic ally of mine when I began in 2008 to find all the stuff that's up on Mars. Because he shares my opinion that the discovery of life on Mars is the leading issue in exopolitics at this point, because it indicates that the planet that every 2 years comes closest to Earth, namely the planet Mars, is inhabited, and therefore a major thrust of exopolitics, if we're going to make exopolitics a fully fledged discipline in civilization, is going to be enacting a Mars Protectorate Treaty, we believe under the United Nations, to protect Mars from visitation, exploration, habitation, and colonization by human beings from Earth. So Alfred understood early on the significance of my finding that Mars is inhabited. Now, I'm not the first person to suggest that Mars is inhabited. That's part of a rich history in natural history that goes all the way back to Schiaparelli's assertions about there being canali on Mars that was picked up by Flammarion and Percival Lowell and Tesla toward the turn of the previous century. And there's been a rich history really for 100 years or more in which different individuals have contributed that discourse. Obviously, more recently, individuals like Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra, like Graham Hancock, like Robert Bobal, in terms of the Egyptian connection on Mars. So I'm not claiming discoveryship of ancient artifacts on Mars. In fact, I'm claiming discoveryship of the notion that Mars is presently inhabited. And I do that in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars. Now, Alfred was in consultation with me throughout 2008. When I finally summed up everything I had found in NASA image PIA 10214. And since then, since late 2008, has been lending his website, www.exopolitics.com, to post my research papers in different critical letters. Like, for example, when I wrote the National Geographic, asking them to collaborate with me to publish my findings of what's on Mars. Because what's up there is not just ancient artifacts. What's up there are humanoid beings of different types and different animal species, and also ruins that we've now identified that make the case not just for ancient habitation of Mars, but for the ancient Egyptian, ancient...
Are there...
much more clear. Yes, I apologize. I have another call coming in. So we have called The Discovery of Life on Mars. And Alfred has also been reporting on the pages of the Denver Examiner as the Seattle Exopolitics Examiner during critical phases of the truth campaign that I've been waging regarding Mars. Okay. And so those documents can be found in a feature entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars at exopolitics.com. We're also mirroring those at the Facebook group site called The Discovery of Life on Mars, and your listeners can, I would urge them to join my Facebook group to keep abreast of the activities and publications of the organization that I founded and of which I'm president, and which Alfred, again, graciously accepted the position as chairman of the board of advisors to the Mars Anomaly Research Society, which we hope to build into the leading organization in the world that will research and disclose and educate the public about life on Mars, and formulate law and policy development regarding protecting the ecology and the civilization of Mars from human beings here on Earth. Ultimately, as I said, in the form of a Mars Protectorate Treaty that Alfred has already begun sketching out. So the papers are posted there under the recent news section of that Facebook group called The Discovery of Life on Mars. At the current time, we're also developing two websites. One will be the website for the Mars Anomaly Research Society, which will be at www.projectmars.net. And I'm going to be launching a separate website regarding my Pegasus revelations at www.projectpegasus.net. But those are still in development. So for now, we're working through the Facebook site. I'm corresponding with people on Facebook. We already have research associates identified from Canada, the United Kingdom, Italy, and Australia. So we're going to be asking individuals who make important discoveries regarding life on Mars, when they're from a new country, we're asking them whether they want to be the research associate from that particular country. And hopefully we will have a research associate from every country in the world who will also correspond with Mars anomalies in that country. But already, Antonio Di Bello, who is a lawyer from Italy, has sent me very valuable data, including another image of a humanoid being on Mars. And I also have, separate in part from him, I received an image, a NASA image, that I was asked to investigate by our Australian research associate. I don't want to mention his name because we haven't asked him yet to be our research associate, but this individual in Australia has also sent me an image that I found another humanoid in. So we're building a network, an international network of research associates, and we're going to be doing presentations on those websites, particularly on ProjectMars.net regarding our Mars findings, but also trying to spearhead the international effort to advance Mars anomaly research so that the people of the world ultimately know the truth, the natural history of their own solar system, which everybody has a human right to know that we live in an inhabited solar system, not just because there's life on Earth, but because there's also life on Mars. So, but until we get those websites up, we're relying on posting the Mars papers at exopolitics.com and also at that Facebook group entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. Again, facebook.com, search for The Discovery of Life on Mars, and take a look at exopolitics.com. And if you're listening to this later down the road, so to speak, when this interview has been posted, please also take a look at projectmars.net and projectpegasus.net for more information, as those sites will be available and up down the road here. Stay with us, Andrew, and we'll talk more after this break. Okay, that's our first hour with Andrew DiBasciago, our Q&A selection of a few of the questions that came in to us after our first program we did with Andrew. We are going to continue for another 2 hours now in our member section, and we are primarily going to focus on Mars and his testimony of how he ended up there. We talk about the purpose for him going there and how things was on Mars and the human astronauts or colonizers that he met there. We also talk about his encounter with some of the animals and the Martians there. We discuss underground bases on Mars, the human presence there, his teleportation trip, and a little bit more on how the teleportation device worked, both on the sending and receiving end. We talk about the catastrophe in 9500 BC or thereabout, what happened to Mars and on Earth. We talk about pre-civilization and some of the Egyptian-style artifacts and others that Andrew has highlighted in photographs of Mars that are available from NASA and other space agencies. And it's a very interesting story. Obviously, we can't confirm if it's true at this point. All we have is Andrew's testimony. And this is something that time might reveal to be true or false, depending on the evidence that could become available if we actually go to Mars. And depending, of course, on what they let us see once they get there. Several interesting anomalies and strange things have shown themselves in photos in pretty much all the probes, robots, and rovers that NASA and other space agencies have sent there. So something is going on. The question is what? Andrew's story could also be verified if other people that Andrew worked with during the Pegasus project decides to come forward to verify the story. And again, we can't confirm if it's true or not, but we present it to you as it is, and as always, we ask you to use your own judgment on this issue. So, if you want to hear more, join us for 2 more hours with Andrew in our member section. All information on how to sign up and tune in can be found on our website, redicecreations.com. It's safe, easy, and simple to sign up and get full access to our material in our member section. Also, by the way, don't miss our walkthrough tour of the Rosicrucian Park in San Jose that we just added in our member section. It's 30 minutes long that goes into the origins of AMORC, the ancient mystical order of the Rose Cross. We look at the founders, Harvey Spencer Lewis and his son Ralph M. Lewis, and talk about some of the occult arts they and other Rosicrucians are using and studying. We look at some of the official material from the Rosicrucian Order, and we highlight some material from former AMORC member Pierre S. Freeman, his controversial testimony of mind control techniques used by the AMORC. We look at the symbolism, architecture, monuments, sphinxes, the obelisk, and other statues around the park. We also take a peek in the Egyptian Museum and look at some of the artifacts inside. Egyptian, Assyrian, Sumerian, and other stuff. So do take a look. All right, we'll be back with Hour 2 and 3 after this break.